This is Focus. It's our morning talk show, and I'm very pleased to have here back on the program once again David Sinnoh, a man who has been an important fixture here on the program for a long time, making a regular appearance once a month on a Friday to talk about money management topics. He begins by making a few comments, sometimes about investing, sometimes about the economy. And then if people have questions about that or anything else, Dave, I know we'll do his best. So if you want to call and ask a specific question about your own situation, you know, you can do that. Either way, we're here and open to questions and very happy to have you back here once
again.
Well,
good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. And you use the term fixture. You're right. It's been over 20 years. Yeah. And obviously, I'm pleased to be part of the WILL family, and especially during this important pledge drive period. So anyone who calls in with a pledge during the time that I'm on the air, I'll add $10 to that pledge. All right, let's get right to it and talk about stocks, because stocks and volatility seems to be on everybody's mind based upon the emails I receive, based upon the phone calls I receive. Unquestionably, it's been a brutal past 6 months for the stock market. And during this period, almost all asset classes, at least in the stock area, suffered double-digit losses, thereby wiping out earlier gains for the year. Especially hard hit, of course, as we know, are the international component of the stock market. Europe, which, of course, we've been reading about every day. They're meeting every day. Merkel is meeting every day with the French, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as well as the emerging markets, another tough asset class, which is almost down 20% for the year. And of course, even a diversified stock portfolio has not escaped damage. For example, our couch potato portfolio year to date is a negative 8.2% through last night's close. Now, interestingly enough, our benchmark, the S&P 500 index, has lost less than 2% of its value year to date. So we have a real anomaly. This is the first time in many, many years where our couch potato portfolio is really falling behind significantly from just the good old-fashioned S&P 500 index. It tells us, because we have a 30% commitment to the international stock arena, that's where we're getting beat up, and that really accounts for the difference. Now, in the short run, there are important lessons and takeaways to be learned, or at least to be reemphasized. First, as we all know, the stock markets can be very volatile over relatively short periods of time. And for the average investor, a short-term commitment to the stock market is just not possible. It's fraught with danger. I continue to counsel, as I have counseled for many years, that our stocks are a very long-term commitment. And even a 10-year commitment to the stock market is simply too short. We're talking 15, 20, 25, even 30-year periods of time. I ask you to think as a long-term investor, as a legacy investor. Second, as we near retirement, prudent investors have stockpiled funds in fixed income. They have fixed income instruments. They have CDs. They have money markets, which can be accessed in retirement when stocks decrease in value. In fact, it should be everyone's goal as they near retirement to be able to access fixed income investments for a period of up to 3 years to cover their expenses. Note that, of course, fixed income includes any Social Security one receives, any pension income one receives, any annuity income one receives. There is nothing worse financially than being forced to sell stocks in retirement after a precipitous drop in order to fund your retirement cash flow. I continue to believe in and invest in the stock market. Remember, your biggest financial enemy is not the stock market, not the ups and downs of the stock market. Your biggest financial enemy over long, long periods of time is the erosion of your purchasing power. In other words, inflation. And historically, over long periods of time, a diversified stock portfolio has been one of the best hedges to deal with inflation and the erosion of your purchasing power. Now, interestingly enough, there are some economic signs, we heard them just a few minutes ago on WILL National News, that are beginning to point in the right direction. One, manufacturing is actually picking up, especially in the Midwest. Good news for the Rust Belt. Two, new claims for unemployment, at least based on four-week averages, is continuing to trend down, and it's at its lowest level in the last 6 months. Three, corporate profits remain solid. Look at McDonald's, look at GE, look at Microsoft, look at a whole host of companies that are reporting very, very positive cash flows. Four, the index of leading economic indicators rose for the sixth consecutive month. And five, retail sales are pretty decent, especially when one considers that Americans continue to pay down debt simultaneously while retail sales are actually increasing. Now, these items of news don't get much play. It's all about Europe. It's all about Greece. It's all about sovereign debt. It's all about default. And these things get pushed into the background, but these are important fundamentals that are buoying up the stock market. Of course, there are two big elephants in the dining room or in the china closet, and they remain unemployment, at least in the United States, and a very, very tough housing market. Now, if we add together all of the people who are unemployed, who are actively seeking work, and we add to that the number of people who are underemployed, they have some type of position, but certainly not the kind of employment position they desire, or we simply add to that the number of people who have said, forget it, I've dropped out, I'm no longer seeking employment, that represents way, way north of 20 million workers in the United States. 20 million people who are not paying income tax, 20 million people who are not paying Social Security and Medicare tax. That's an enormous problem. We hear 9.1% unemployment. Those are the folks who are actively seeking employment. We add everyone else, that number is somewhere in the 15 to 16% range, depending upon who you believe. All right, that's one major elephant. It hasn't moved. It's very stubborn. We've been creating somewhere between 50 and 100,000 jobs a month. We need to double, triple, even quadruple that to get some play, to get some downward motion in unemployment. And with respect to housing, most economists agree that sales of previously occupied homes needs to approximate 6 million. 6 million units to be considered a healthy housing market. Year-to-date statistics point out that we're going to be somewhere in the range of 4.5, and optimistic projections put it at 4.9 million. So we have a long way to go. We have tremendous amounts of excess inventory. We have tremendous numbers of foreclosures that haven't even hit the market. So this two-punch combination is very, very tough for the administration and Congress to do much about. Very interesting are the number of foreign buyers who are now buying U.S. homes. This is really quite interesting. And it was reported again in CNN Money just this morning that international purchases of American homes are really ramping up. And indeed, get a load of this, there is a new Senate bill designed to just go after the foreign market and encourage these investors to buy even more homes. The bill is co-sponsored by Charles Schumer, who is a Democrat from New York, Mike Lee, interestingly enough, a Republican from Utah. And here's what it will do. It will grant special visas to foreign people to come over to the United States and spend at least $500,000. I guess that counts my house out, David. I don't know about yours. $500,000 on residential real estate in the United States. It is now finding its way through Congress, and apparently it has a lot of support. In fact, foreigners spent over $80 billion during the last 12 months buying homes. That's up 24% from foreign investment in residential housing as compared to a year earlier. Where are they buying these homes? Imagine this: Florida, California, Texas, Hawaii, and New York. In fact, it's estimated that now 25% of the Florida market are international buyers. Now, do they go through Fannie Mae? Do they go through Freddie Mac? Do they try to apply for a loan? Oh, no. These are cash buyers. And in fact, the legislation as proposed is specifically for cash buyers. These foreign buyers would be using hard currency to buy these homes. And indeed, this is actually propping up the South Florida market. And as a result, there is new construction that is now taking place even in South Florida and in Hawaii. Interestingly enough, foreigners seem to have more confidence in the U.S. real estate market than Americans do. Almost half of the foreign buyers who were recently surveyed said that they are investing in residential housing in the United States because of anticipated profitability and safety of their investments as a main factor. Isn't it interesting that we look at international folks who are now spending more and more of their dollars reinvesting in America? And frankly, in the short run, that's a good thing. That's a good thing because it removes excess housing stock and it will provide some floor of stability for the housing market. So we have a lot of mixed news at the moment. But I caution people to wholesale sell stocks. I think that's a mistake. I think, again, as I pointed out time and time again, stock market investing is really a lifetime enterprise. And our biggest enemy, as I mentioned, is purchasing power risk, inflation risk, not the ups and downs of the short term of the U.S. and world stock markets. So there you have it, David. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, any questions from our listeners. And again, for anyone who pledges during the time that I'm on the air, I will add $10 to that pledge. And hopefully I'll get up to at least 23 pledges because I think that's about the amount of time now that I've been on with WILL. I don't think that's quite as long as yourself, but pretty close.
Not quite, but we're close,
so I guess we're becoming aging dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah, believe me, every day I get up, I think that that's more and more true. David Sinnoh is here. We're very happy to have him here. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business, and for, as he says, for now more than 20 years, he's been here on a regular basis to talk about money management. And now we're open to your questions. Anything that he's discussed, anything else that has to do with financial planning, call in, ask your question. He might want to ask you a question in return just to make sure that he has the information he needs to try to answer. And then we'll see if we can help you out. So 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Also, if you would like, you can send your question by email, and that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll start us off with someone in Peoria, and that's a caller on our line 4 right here, toll free line. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yes, hope you guys have a good weekend.
Thanks.
You know, I like your statements earlier. I was listening to you. You know, I just think it's odd that it seems like foreigners have more money than the average American citizen. It's kind of nice to hear that they're trying to invest in the United States of America. But I wonder, a lot of these people are on visas, so they don't, you know, really, to me, stay here all as long as you think they are. Some of them here, I'm close to Fermilab up in the northern part of the state.
Yes.
And, well, a lot of these guys that work at Fermilab are only here for a couple years and then they're gone, so their house is like it's like a boomerang. A lot of the houses around Batavia, St. Charles, Geneva area, there's a lot of, I don't want to say transients, but a lot of this influx of people coming and going. And on top of the economy being as bad as it is, you know, it just, the real estate market in general is, I think it's going to be a long time before it recovers. But
I think you raised some good points. Number one, this is a long-term investment. The investors that I'm talking about are people who are coming in and viewing this as a long-term investment, not talking about people who are coming here from another country and are spending 1 or 2 years here and probably make a big mistake by buying real estate. I've said for years, if you're only going to think of being in a piece of real estate for 1, 2, even 3 years. That's way too short a period of time. And interestingly enough, the people who are buying, a lot of them are coming from Canada because the currency has really switched around in Canada. It wasn't too long ago where the American buck was worth more than that Canadian maple leaf, the loonie.
The loonie.
The loonie, and that has really switched. So remember that a lot of these buyers, as a result of the euro value as compared to the dollar, they're looking at things extra cheap. They think they're buying on the cheap because they're getting, you know, again, they're spending 70 cents to for a dollar of real estate, essentially.
It's crazy, too, when I think about it. The mortgage rates and everything, the percentage rates is way down there, and nobody's buying yet. And it's
people can't qualify. People can't qualify. Number one, they're out of work. Number two, their houses are underwater, so it's a huge problem.
I work with a lot of people. I'm in the trades, so I took it, you know, it's bad. I don't think it's ever going to be like it used to be. But, you know, when I'm sitting here and I deal with a lot with real estate, it's crazy the things you can find. I know there's million-dollar houses right now that are going for, you know, maybe not even $500,000.
Yes.
You know, all over the country. And it's a good investment. But, see, here's the problem. The one where I'm at is that kills the deal is the property taxes. And as crazy as it sounds, that's one thing in the state of Illinois that I used to live in different states. I'm a salesperson
okay.
at the same time, so I'm bouncing all over the place. I
mm-hmm.
got an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens to be the worst state as far as how it taxes people as far as real estate.
Well, it's one of the more onerous states. There are other onerous states as well. Talk to people who own residential real estate in Florida, for example, and certain other states. But you are correct that because of the state of Illinois and the system that we're in, that real estate has been heavily relied on, real estate taxes, transfer taxes, to fund an awful lot of stuff, so to speak, in the state of Illinois. So your points are well taken. We appreciate them. I see we have a bunch of phone calls, so thank you very, very much.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. I just, I guess like the caller, when you were talking about people outside of the United States buying homes in the country, my question was, well, what do they do? Do they rent them out, or is it something they just think as long as it's maintained, if its value goes up over time, then that's what they're
Well, they're doing two things, David. Some of them are actually being rented out, and also a number of these folks are spending substantial time in the United States.
Oh, some of them might actually be living mm-hmm. in that house for
6 months of the year.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, let's take some other folks here. Charleston is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I know we don't have much time, so we'll try to be short. But I'd like to challenge that notion that, you know, you're in it for the long term. Because I think that used to be the case for individual investors. But since we were kind of confronted with this fact that fewer and fewer people have the majority of the money, you know, that disparagement between the high and the low earners, it seems like that top 1%, they're in it for the short term. And they're using these complex algorithms to get in within microseconds of a deal. And it's hard to fight that fluctuation. And then a great example of why I don't think it's safe to be in long-term anymore like it used to be is Enron. You had Enron executives able to trade their shares of the stock, but everybody else, the common shareholder, was locked out. So those people were in it for the long term, and they lost everything.
Well,
I mean, it's like the world has changed. I don't think that idea of long-term investment is really the same that it used to be. Can you speak on that?
I certainly can. Remember that when I talk about a long-term investor, I'm buying baskets and baskets and baskets of stocks. I'm owning basically thousands and thousands of stocks simultaneously. I am not an individual stock market investor because you brought up the classic case of Enron, and that in financial terms is called unsystematic risk. That's the risk of owning 1, 2, 3, even 4, 5, 6, 7 companies, and 1, 2, or 3 of them blow up. And as a result, it blows up your entire portfolio. So I'm not into that. I'm not sophisticated enough. You bring up something else about the fact that we've now have specialized traders who are trading mathematically in milliseconds, in millionths of a second, and that is true. And it actually represents now somewhere between 40 to 50% of the overall volume on any given day. And the SEC is now starting to look into this because it has to create more volatility in the stock market. Nevertheless, I am a perennial optimist. Okay? I think it's very, very tough to live a long life without some sense of optimism. And the essential question is, would you rather be an owner of companies or would you rather be a lender to companies? If you're a lender, you're a buyer of bonds. You're a buyer of CDs. You're a buyer of money markets. If you're an owner of a company and you want to share in the growth of a company, then you have to own stock. There's a place for both. But if you are going to be a stock investor, it's very, very tough to deal with computer traders, mathematical algorithms, individual stocks. And that's why I've counseled as a long-term strategy, which over very long periods of time continues to outperform almost any other investment, but it takes a lot of patience, and that is owning a diversified portfolio of baskets and baskets of stocks across various asset classes. So I continue to believe, while many people say we're in a new normal, okay, maybe the new normal is lesser returns, but still returns nevertheless. And one way to garner those returns is having a diversified portfolio of indexes or asset class stocks. But as far as buying Enron, as far as buying individual stocks, I couldn't agree more with the caller. Mm-hmm. You're preaching to the choir.
Again, I want to thank the caller. David Sinnoh is our guest, by the way. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois, and for a long time has been with us once a month on a Friday to talk a little bit about investing in money management. So if you have a question about financial planning, something very specific to your situation, give us a call. And Dave will see if we can help you out. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Mahomet, line 2. Hello.
Good morning, David and David. Hi. I have a more specific question to ask you regarding capital gains. My husband owns stock in a closely held agricultural company here in Illinois. They had an excess cash and declared it one-time dividend, a very generous dividend. And I am wondering what the cap gains tax would be on that is my first question. And my second question is, should I be looking at making estimated tax payments for this? As I said, it was rather generous in the five figures, and so I didn't know if I was going to get into trouble come tax time in April. Thank you.
Those are great questions, and I'm not sure that I can properly answer them, and I would suggest and counsel you to talk to your accountant or your CPA or your tax specialist. But let's just try to tackle them partially.
Okay.
When you have a special amount of income that comes in from some source, and you say, oh my, this is going to be significantly more than we reported last year, the general rule of thumb is, have you paid in at least 100% of what you paid in last year by the end of the year?
Yes.
So whatever your taxes were last year, have you, by the end of the year, are you going to at least pay in 100%?
Yes, we will.
Okay. Well, then you should be relatively safe, and then you could essentially pay that difference come when you pay your taxes, which should be on or before April 15th. Obviously, if you report and file an extension on April 15th, you're going to have to pay those taxes if you haven't filed your final return for 2011 by April of 2012. Okay?
What now, is the percentage
well,
on that?
Well, generally, it depends on the kind of dividend and the kind of corporate structure. It may be 15%. And depending upon the nature of the company, how it was declared, what it really is, it may be taxed at your highest marginal rate. So I would ask the company, first of all, their accountant, if it's a substantial company, to advise you. And then after they advise you, then I would talk to my individual accountant. But it's either going to be 15% federal. We know it's going to be 5% state of Illinois. You're a resident of Illinois, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so we know that all income, any kind of dividend income, capital gain income, whatever it may be characterized, is going to be taxed at 5% state of Illinois. And state of Illinois is really, really careful about this, so make sure that you've paid in enough in the state of Illinois so you don't get penalized, because they love to penalize people. They don't have any money to pay people, but they love to penalize people. Right. And then the question becomes, is this going to be a 15% federal tax, or is it simply going to be taxed at your highest marginal rate? And I really don't have enough information from what you've given me to tell you the correct answer.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Very good. I have an email here I want to get in, and then we'll have another caller here. This is and I get. I think we've kind of had questions along this line before. It's a question about the program the state of Illinois has for paying for college for your kids. So the listener says, I have $55,000 in College, Illinois for my two kids, 1-7 and 1-11, and I am worried about the state of Illinois not backing this. I assumed, he said, when he bought it, he assumed that, in fact, when the time came for the kids to go to school, the state would be there and would fulfill its commitment. Now, he goes on to say, I owe about $39,000 on his mortgage, which is at a 4.75% interest rate. And he wonders, would it be better to pay off the mortgage with that money? Or do you think that when the time comes when his children are ready to go to college, that it will be there when they need it? And he goes on to say he's pretty disappointed in the way the product was promoted as something that would guard against the increase in the cost of college education. And now they're sort of saying, well, it went up faster than we thought, so we're really not quite so sure. So, again, I guess the big question is, for people who are in that kind of a program, when the time comes for their children to go to college, will the state fulfill its commitment?
And you're asking a $64 question because it was sold, and most people believe that it was guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the state. Mm-hmm. In fact, the fine print pointed out that, no, it was not backed by the full faith and credit of the state. My belief is, in terms of the practicality of the situation, is that we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of families in the state of Illinois who put their trust in College, Illinois. And there would be such a political outcry, there would be such rioting in the streets down in Springfield, that the state of Illinois, in my view, is going to have to make good on those particular promises. So my view is, and I have counseled people on this, that I believe that the integrity of the College of Illinois program will be maintained, but it will be maintained on the backs of taxpayers and increased costs for the program, for people who are putting money into the program to protect against these huge inflationary increases in tuition at state colleges.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month, we do these shows on money management, and we will talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids, Mohammed, Provena Covenant Medical Center, Urbana, First National Bank and Trust Company, Clinton, and Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
There's another place that the money for this station, from which the money for this station comes, and that's people like you, folks who are listening to us right now. It is, in fact, the most important source of support we have. And we often use that investment metaphor, but on a show like this, when Dave is here, it's particularly appropriate because we talk about investing. Well, okay. So we're sitting here in front of the microphone and we're saying, please make a financial contribution to the station. And we talk about it in terms of being an investment. And you say, well, okay, what am I getting out of this? Well, I'll tell you what it is. When you turn on the radio, this show is here. Morning Edition's here. All Things Considered is here. Ag Reporting. Everything we do on this station depends so heavily on listener contributions. We answer to you. We try really hard as a way of backing up the commitment that this is your station. Well, we hope that if you feel it's your station, you'll take some ownership. And that means helping to pay part of the cost of keeping the station on the air. This is one of a very few times that we interrupt the programming with this message. But it's important we get the message out there. Amy Stewart Ray is here in the studio with me. She's a member of our development staff, and she's here to help me make the pitch that people should pick up the phone or go to their computer and make that contribution. Maybe you should get in the phone number here.
Absolutely, David. I'd be happy to. If you could call 217-244-9455 right now and make your pledge of support to WILL and help support the programs that you value and count on every day, just like Focus.
That's, you know, it's kind of easy to take it for granted. You turn on the radio, the show's there. And most of the time, what we want to do is we just want to do the show. We're glad that we don't have to stop every couple of minutes and say, would you give us some money? No, we don't do that. That's not our model. But the model we have does depend on us occasionally to say, would you please give us some money? And you know, that's kind of a crude way of putting it. But what we're really doing is we're saying, this is our energy source.
Absolutely.
That's
so
where
important.
The money for the programs comes from.
No, this is listener-supported radio. And the largest portion of our annual member fundraising budget does come from our individual members, from people just like you who pick up the phone, call with their pledge of support, or if you prefer, you can go to willpledge.org and make your pledge of support online. But this is our fall drive, a very important part of our fundraising campaign, and we could use a phone call from you right now.
Yeah. Just one other thing I want to mention, because it's special and this has been in the works for a while, we have various ways of saying thanks for making a contribution. And we wanted to do something to celebrate the fact that this show has been in the air now 30 years.
Which is quite...
I can't believe it.
Quite an occasion. Quite an accomplishment.
And we thought, well, so, you know, we interview a lot of authors. We believe in books. And we have a special bookmark that
sure
we have
do.
Made. And it, in fact, we have one of them sitting here right on the table.
Absolutely, we do. And it is your thank you gift with a pledge of $75 today. It is a beautiful Focus 30th anniversary leather bookmark. It's beautifully embossed with the Illinois Public Media logo. And you can get that thank you gift right now if you call with your pledge of support for $75.
Yeah, it's really nice. I think that it should last for a while. It's substantial enough so it will mark your place in the book, but it's not going to make a big lump.
No, it's a beautiful. It's a beautiful bookmark.
It's really nice. Heather Miller put a lot of effort into having that made for us. And it's a kind of a special thing. So I think there are a lot of people I know listen to the show and tell me that they enjoy the interviews that they've heard. Here's a little souvenir, a special commemorative souvenir, not available in stores.
Absolutely not.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Just here at WILL.
If you will call in and make a contribution. And the you know, we shouldn't make it sound like it's more difficult than it is, making a pledge. Real quick, really easy.
No, just takes a few minutes of your time. That number, 217-244-9455. Someone is waiting to answer your call and just take a few bits of information from you. The process is quick, it's painless, and it is an important part of the support that we need to receive from you, a member of our listening community.
Yeah, we're just getting going here. We'll be here today and through the weekend and in the beginning of next week. And overall, how many people now are we hoping that we can hear from?
Well, we are hoping to hear from 1,200 listeners during this October radio drive. And I can tell you that so far today, we've received 87 phone calls, 87 pledges of support, and I believe 30 web pledges as well. So we are really sort of having an outstanding start to this drive. We're very excited about it here at WILL, but we still need to hear from you. Please call 217-244-9455.
That's right. We need to keep the momentum going. And if you make a $75 pledge, we'll send you the 30th anniversary Focus bookmark, which is really a cool thing.
It is. It's a beautiful thank you gift and a very special one.
All right. Thanks, Amy. We have a couple of people here ready to go. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's on the program once a month on a Friday. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And we talk about money management and investing. And so if you have a specific question for your own situation, give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have callers. That's what we'll do here next. Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Professor Sinnoh, I have a question. Could you explain to me the differences between an exchange-traded fund and a regular mutual fund? And if you believe there's any inherent volatility that affects the risk quotient in exchange-traded funds?
Those are great questions. An exchange-traded fund is really a tracking stock. It trades all day long, just like a stock, but it tracks a particular index, like the S&P 500 index. So the ETF is often referred to as an SPDR, a spider. And you can purchase that on an exchange. You could purchase that through a brokerage firm. Now, in contradistinction to a tracking stock or ETF is a mutual fund. And we all know about mutual funds, but mutual funds are priced generally only once a day at their net asset value, which means at the end of the day, we look at all of the securities and financial instruments that are comprised in that fund. We price them at their closing price at the end of the day. We divide that total price by the number of shares of the fund, and hence we then obtain the net asset value per share of that particular fund. Now, we have to be careful because with ETFs, every time you buy one, you sell one, you have a commission. And it depends upon where you're trading, how you're trading, will depend then on what level of commission you are paying. So be careful of commissions. Number two, some ETFs have liquidity issues, and that is they're not very large. And when something isn't very large, if a trader comes in and buys or sells, there can be a very substantial difference between the bid and the ask price of that ETF. So ETFs can have more volatility, especially those that are thinly traded or are not substantially large. They have limited liquidity, so to speak. Now, with a mutual fund, for example, if you were going to buy an index at Vanguard, you might have to spend as much as $3,000 to purchase that mutual fund. With an ETF, could I spend $500? Could I spend $700? Could I spend $300? And the answer is clearly yes. So there is some flexibility in terms of the dollar amount that you have to commit to an ETF as opposed to a mutual fund, which might have a minimum of, say, $3,000. So each may have their place in a portfolio. Many, many ETFs simply mirror different indexes. And there are literally scores and scores of ETFs that you can purchase. So look for liquidity. Mm-hmm. Look for size of the ETF. Mm-hmm. Look for the commission expense of purchasing that ETF. And if all of those things ring true and you feel comfortable with them, there is no reason not to buy an ETF as opposed to perhaps a mutual fund. Now, remember, with ETFs, you've got professional traders, and they're buying and selling all day. Many, many mutual funds have placed penalties on early entrance and early exit from a mutual fund to dissuade traders from trading in that particular mutual fund. Now, does that help?
Yes, that's what I was wondering, is since you can trade all through the day, if this actually creates more volatility also.
Well, it may or may not, depending upon the markets. Markets create volatility, the individual instruments, depending on whether you have professional traders or algorithmic traders, that can create volatility in a specific ETF. But remember, every time someone is trading in an ETF, there is a tiny commission that may be involved with that trade. And as for you, when you buy or sell an ETF as a retail customer, just like myself, we're going to pay a rather substantial commission.
I see. Well, thank you. That's very, very, very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Well, let's continue. And our next caller is in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello. Hmm? My wife and I, fortunately, do not depend on income from our investments. I was 70 last week, and she's 68. Do you have recommendations about the percentage of a investment portfolio that should be in equities for somebody at this advanced age?
All right. So are you telling me that you have other income sources like pensions and Social Security, which are really what you're living on, and this is sort of additional money?
Right. Yes, that's right.
Okay. So what I want you to think about, and this is very interesting, most people who have Social Security income and pension income don't think of that income as fixed income, but it really is. It's almost like bond income. So what you would need to do is take the total amount of money that is coming in and place a factor on it of some interest rate and say to yourself, gee, how much fixed income would I have to have at 3%, 4%, 5% to generate the kind of pension income and Social Security income that I'm enjoying with my wife. Never mind the inflation factor. Just forget about that. So we'll be even more conservative. And what you're going to find is that that is a very large number. So, for example, if you have pension and Social Security income of $40,000 per year, that would require $1 million at 4%. All right? And you have to think of that as fixed income. So now when we do our overall asset allocation and we say, gee, I've got this engine of $1 million of fixed income out here, and I thought I'm overweighted in stocks because my other IRA portfolio, my Roths, my 403Bs, my defined contributions, whatever they may be, I thought I was overweighted because I've got 40 or 50% of that in stocks. When you do your overall asset allocation, you might find out that that drops precipitously to maybe 15 or 20%. So I think the biggest mistake that people make, and by the way, congratulations on reaching 70. You'll be happy to know that people who are approximately 70, at least one of you has a 45% chance of living to 90. Okay? All right? And hopefully in good health. Hopefully in good health. Then your biggest enemy in retirement is purchasing power risk. If you have Social Security, which is indexed for inflation, if you have pensions indexed for inflation, that helps a lot. But again, another hedge would be a reasonable position in stocks. So, one, you have to feel comfortable with your position in stocks. And then, two, you have to look at it mathematically based upon your entire net worth. What percentage of my entire net worth really is in stocks when I consider the fixed income value of my pensions and my Social Security? And I think you're going to find it's less than you thought.
Right. I see. That's a very good point, and I hadn't considered that. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, very
my pleasure.
Good. Thank you. On again to another Champagne caller. This is line three. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Sure.
I have been looking into options, specifically writing covered calls. I think I know pretty well how they work, but I can't find a real downside risk to them. Am I missing something?
Well, if you own the stock,
yes,
and you're going to own the stock, say 100 shares of IBM, AT&T, you name it, McDonald's, whatever, Walgreens, if you own the stock, and then you are going to write a call, that means you are going to collect premium from someone else, and you are going to give them the right to take that stock from you.
Yes.
All right?
Yeah.
And as long as the stocks that you are working with don't have a lot of volatility, a lot of people use this strategy. It's one of the more conservative strategies, but I caution you, you need to have the underlying position already in your brokerage account.
Sure.
That's important,
right,
to have that underlying position because it can be called away from you, and you would hate to have to go out and buy that position, and the stock was $10 or $15 a share higher.
Yeah, I understand that, yeah.
Have you done this before?
Pardon?
Have you done it so far? Have you actually executed a trade?
Actually, I have just started doing that.
Okay.
I would only write the covered call. I would have the the underlying stock. But it seems to me like the only downside to this is if the option is exercised,
correct?
That you may lose some opportunity by having to sell a stock that's on its way up.
Right. And alternatively, if you have to also be willing to hold that stock if the stock moves against you.
Yeah.
So if you are comfortable with 100 shares of McDonald's or 100 shares of Walgreens or 100 shares of whatever it is, because an options contract basically is 100 shares, then and you're comfortable and you're not risking a great deal of your portfolio, it's a strategy that many, many people utilize to build additional income, to build additional return on their portfolio.
That's the idea. Well, that answers my question, I think. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. We have about maybe 3-4 minutes here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I did have a quick want to ask you a question here, a follow-up. We got by email to someone who was listening to the conversation about College, Illinois, and where you said to somebody who was in the program, mm-hmm. you'd say, you'd say hang in. Mm-hmm. Now, what this person is asking is, okay, would you then advise someone to start now if they're not already in it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that you are better off in a 529 plan. And there are two kinds of 529 plans. One is a prepaid tuition plan. That's called College Illinois. Or simply investing your money in a 529 plan and then taking on the investment risk. And if you have a very young child and you're looking at 15 to 20 years, I would look at any number of 529 plans. These are all state-supported plans. You could go to any mutual fund, including Vanguard, for example, and put together a very, very lovely portfolio that you can continue to dollar-cost average into over the next 15 to 18 years, and I think you would be ahead doing that.
Okay. Something else, I just in when you were talking with the previous caller about the likelihood that at his age, I think he said he was 70 and his mm-hmm. wife was 68, mm-hmm. and there mm-hmm. was a good possibility mm-hmm. that one of them would live into their 90s. I wonder now as people are doing their planning for the future, whether, in fact, we are taking into account the kinds of increases in longevity that we actually
risk, David,
see now.
Absolutely. Longevity risk is a huge, huge factor. It goes back to purchasing power risk. And that is the biggest fear older people have is running out of money before they run out of life. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge problem. And it's just a geometrically growing problem in America as all of us age. I mean, after all, David, a fellow who's been around 30 years on the radio, you know, and lived to tell the story, you're an excellent candidate probably to be, what is it called if you're 100 years old? Is that a septuagenarian?
A centenarian.
Centenarian. Is that what it is? I couldn't remember.
I think so.
Well, maybe we'll still be here, David.
That would certainly reflect a shocking lack of ambition. 30 years in one place is bad enough. And when we're here, Dave, if you and I are here when we're in our 90s, something is wrong.
I don't know. I think maybe our wives will be unhappy.
I expect probably so. We have about a minute or two here. Was there any last sort of little thing you might
want
to mention?
Well, I wanted to just mention something again about real estate. There's a whole lot of foreclosures and foreclosed properties that have not come to the market. So I don't look for really tremendous increases in prices in the American real estate market. And CNN Money just reported this morning that once borrowers start missing payments, they spend an average of a year and 9 months or 611 days in the home without making any payments because banks are basically slow. There is so much regulation, et cetera, to foreclose on a property. And that's why it's estimated that there are literally still millions and millions of bank-held properties where the foreclosure process isn't even complete. So if people are worried about, gee, I'm missing an opportunity, I should jump out there and buy real estate today, I think it's a great time to buy, but I think you're not going to miss an opportunity if you wait 3, 6, 9 months.
All right. David Suno, he's with us once a month on Friday. He's clinical professor of finance in U of I College of Business, and we've been doing this show for a long, long time here to give people this practical opportunity to ask very specific questions about their own investing situation. And we hope that we have helped people over the years. I think that we have.
I think so. And David, it's really been a tremendous honor and a privilege to be part of the WILL family. I hope that I've contributed in a significant way, and I just urge all of the listeners to this program and to the many wonderful programs on WILL to support financially these endeavors, because WILL is really a dinosaur. It's a real icon. It's a tremendous value to not only the University of Illinois community, but wherever these programs reach. And I, for one, enjoy WILL. I've enjoyed you. And I think you have just been so important and such a key element of WILL that my hat's just off to you, David. And thank you for just the opportunity to participate.
Well, we also thank you for your contribution all these years. And if there are people who have now listened to those kind words that Dr. Suno has said, and you're not a supporter, now's the time. You should pick up the telephone, go to the computer, make a financial contribution, because you're supporting this show, Focus, but also everything else that we have on this station. That is, you know, we're a public radio station, so we pay for this show and the others that we broadcast with the money that listeners contribute. That is what you're doing with your contribution. You're helping to pay the costs of bringing you the programs that you enjoy. That's why we can do it without commercials. But we also have to, a couple of times throughout the year, sit here in front of the microphones and put it just right like that. Say, if the programs are important, how about making a pledge? Amy Stewart Ray is here in the studio with me. She's one of our development staff, here to help me get people to go to the phone.
Absolutely. Or step over to their computer and make their pledge online at willpledge.org right now. I actually just received an update from Rita Schulte, our Director of Membership and Marketing here. We so far today have we are at 220 pledges, which I think at this point on the first day of our October drive is really quite a feat, which means we have 980 pledges to go to hit our goal of 1,200 pledges for this drive. So thank you so much to those of you who have called in or sent in your pledge of support via your computer. But I'd like to ask those of you who haven't made your pledge yet, please give us a call right now at 217-244-9455. It's quick. It's easy to do. You can make your pledge of support with a credit card. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. But please don't delay. Call us now.
Yeah. You know, when we have these shows, when Dave is here, we hope that people will think very carefully about what they do with their money. Because, you know, depending on what sort of investment you make, there may be some risk. And you want to keep the risk as low as possible. Well, there's one thing that we do not want to risk. We do not want to risk you turning on the radio and us not being here. There are certain things that you depend on, and I think that that's one of them, you know, that tomorrow when you turn on the radio, you expect we're going to be there. And this afternoon when you're driving home from work or you're going to the supermarket and you're going wherever you're going, you expect that when you turn your radio on, we're there. We want to be there, believe me. But we want you to understand just how important you are in that whole business of making sure that we are there when you turn on the radio.
Absolutely. And, you know, talking today about financial planning advice and talking about investing for the long term or for the long haul, one option I'd like to offer up to our listeners right now is to please consider becoming a member of WILL for the long haul. And you can do that by, when you call in with your pledge of support, asking about our sustaining membership program. That is a membership option where your membership automatically renews each year. It's quick. It's easy. We don't burden you with renewal emails and renewal mail. It saves us time and money. It's more efficient for you as a member. So please, if you're interested in, when you call in your pledge of support at 217-244-9455, ask about becoming a sustainer.
All right. We'll take a break here for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Thank you so much to those of you who have called in or sent in your pledge of support via your computer. But I'd like to ask those of you who haven't made your pledge yet, please give us a call right now at 217-244-9455. It's quick. It's easy to do. You can make your pledge of support with a credit card. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. But please don't delay. Call us now.
Yeah. You know, when we have these shows, when Dave is here, we hope that people will think very carefully about what they do with their money. Because, you know, depending on what sort of investment you make, there may be some risk, and you want to keep the risk as low as possible. Well, there's one thing that we do not want to risk. We do not want to risk you turning on the radio and us not being here. There are certain things that you depend on, and I think that that's one of them, you know, that tomorrow when you turn on the radio, you expect we're going to be there. And this afternoon when you're driving home from work or you're going to the supermarket and you're going wherever you're going, you expect that when you turn your radio on, we're there. We want to be there, believe me. But we want you to understand just how important you are in that whole business of making sure that we are there when you turn on the radio.
Absolutely. And, you know, talking today about financial planning advice and talking about investing for the long term or for the long haul, one option I'd like to offer up to our listeners right now is to please consider becoming a member of WILL for the long haul. And you can do that by, when you call in with your pledge of support, asking about our sustaining membership program. That is a membership option where your membership automatically renews each year. It's quick. It's easy. We don't burden you with renewal emails and renewal mail. It saves us time and money. It's more efficient for you as a member. So please, if you're interested in, when you call in your pledge of support at 217-244-9455, ask about becoming a sustainer.
All right. We'll take a break here for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Dancing with the Devil on Saturday, October 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Pianist Ian Hobson is featured as Sinfonia and the U of I Women's Glee Club celebrate Franz Liszt's 200th birthday. More information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Double-digit gains over in the wheat pit, helping to prop up corn. Corn up and down the pits, almost at 10-cent gains today.